As we start today, I thought we would maybe open up with the very opening of the Gospel of Matthew, since we've been in Matthew a bit already. So if you would turn to Matthew chapter 1. When we the first day of class, I think I started with Matthew chapter 2, talking about the importance of worship in the book of Matthew, not just because it's repeated three different times in the narrative where the Magi visit Jesus, but also because it shows up at the very end of the book in the Great Commission. And it's very important, usually, how an author starts his book. And Matthew starts it in a way that is just kind of dry and boring. I mean, frankly. I have my Greek students read Matthew after they've had their first series of Beginning Greek, because it's a really interesting narrative, and it's good Greek, and it's not too hard. But I always suggest that they start in chapter 2, because the beginning of Matthew sounds like this: the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. To Abraham was born Isaac, and to Isaac Jacob, and to Jacob Judah and his brothers, and to Judah were born Perez, and Zerah by Tamar. If you think that's exciting, it's even better in Greek. And to Perez was born Hezron, and to Hezron Ram, and to Ram was born Amminadab, and to Amminadab Nashon, and to Nashon Salmon, and to Salmon was born Boaz by Rahab, and to Boaz was born Obed by Ruth, and to Obed Jesse, and to Jesse was born David the king. And we're just a third of the way there through the genealogy, all right? Matthew starts with the genealogy. This is probably very important, again, in the overall theological thrust, the emphases that you have going on in Matthew. Those of you who are aware of the Gospels will know that Luke also has a genealogy. He puts it later in his Gospel, and he traces it in a different direction, and he also goes backwards. Whereas Matthew, in good Jewish Semitic fashion, starts with the father Abraham, and then traces it through subsequent sons and subsequent generations after that. Just a few quick comments about this as a kind of way of getting us into, again, the theological thrusts of Matthew. It's hard to know for sure all the different emphases that are coming out here, because Matthew doesn't stop and say, hey, look, okay, this is what I'm trying to do here, and this is why it matters to me theologically. There's a couple of places where he kind of does. But we should note a few things along the way. One, you'll know if you've looked at this passage before that there are several ladies that show up in the passage. We just met one of them, Boaz by Rahab, and to Boaz was born Obed by Ruth. So you have Rahab, the harlot, and Ruth, the Moabitess, in the list. And it's been striking to many that the very places where the ladies come in, for instance, there's one in the very next verse, verse 6, and to David was born Solomon by her who had been the wife of Uriah. It doesn't even mention Bathsheba's name, but he at least mentions her as the wife of Uriah. It's interesting that these ladies are not pure-blood Jewish ladies. It's possible that the wife of Uriah, he being a Hittite, his wife may have been a Hittite as well. It's also interesting that they are, there would be more embarrassing to you if they were in your genealogy in some respect. I mean, undoubtedly, there are wonderful sets of mothers throughout the genealogy, but he doesn't mention any of them. He mentions the ones that stick out in the narrative of the history of Genesis, and then later into especially the historical books of the Old Testament. The one reason that I think it might be worthwhile pointing that out, we might be making too much of the text, because, again, he doesn't come out and make a little aside and say, hey, look, these are questionable women if you're going to be a good Jewish sire, is the way that he says in verse 6, to David was born Solomon by her who had been the wife of Uriah. Now, he could have easily said Bathsheba there. Undoubtedly, the word was known. But by labeling her as the wife of Uriah, it's a strong reminder, isn't it, not just of her name, but of the whole narrative of David and the way that he had Uriah put to death so that he could marry Bathsheba for himself. And, of course, of their adulterous relationship that preceded all of that. So it's a reminder of some of the failings of David in the process and of her connection in that. So I'm inclined to think that there's something possibly to that. There are a couple of places where he steps back in this narrative or this genealogy and tells us some things that he really does want to notice. The first is at the very opening. This is the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Now, several things. First, genealogy. You guys will know that, you know, having read the Old Testament, the number of genealogies that are there, you know, the ones that you just love to have your devotional life in, right? You know, that those edifying genealogies that go on and on and on and on. Right? Well, these are very important, of course, in a Semitic mindset, and to give a sense of the descendancy of the person, and therefore of their rightful claim to a few key positions. So if you look at the genealogies in the Old Testament, they usually have at least three purposes and perhaps more. If they're generically about Israel as a whole, and the people of Israel as a whole, it's substantiating their Jewishness, which was very important in marriage. Those of you who are aware of the book of Ezra and some of the reforms of Ezra, one of his big concerns is that Jewish men especially were marrying women who were from other countries. And thus the Jewish race was being diluted and also being tempted to go after other deities. Okay? So the very Jewishness of the person was of some significance. But more often than not, the other two areas that the genealogies are important is they establish kingly line. A descendant of David is to stay on the throne of Judah. Or they establish priestly line. Because it was very important that you had a track of the priests so that you would go back to the right group. You know who the Levites were. You'd also knew who the priests were, and especially the priests that qualified of being of Aaron, and especially of Zadok. Because that was who the line of the high priest was supposed to come from. So the genealogies usually aren't just kind of there for fun and show. They're there to establish a number of criteria. So we expect the same when we come here. We also realize that this is very Jewish. It's a very Jewish way to open a gospel. Okay? Which is one of many reasons that I would say that this is possibly written, well, likely written by a Jewish person to Jewish Christians. So that's the word genealogy. Next, the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ. Now, of course, we're familiar with the guy's name. His first name is Jesus, and his second name is Christ. You know, like David Chapman or Charlie Johnson. You know, this is what we have, right? Well, that's, of course, not the case. Christ, as you know, is a title, messianic title, Christos, right? So the book of the genealogy of Jesus, probably better, Jesus the Christ, Jesus the Messiah. Okay? So from the very beginning of the book of Matthew, he's wanting to tell his Jewish Christian audience, this is the Mashiach, this is the Messiah. Right? And then he says, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Now notice they're in reverse direction, aren't they? You would expect the son of Abraham, the son of David, or something like that, or of Abraham and of David. Now, there is... I guess there is something proper going on here in the Greek, because David ultimately is the son of Abraham. So that's why there's an ordering there. But isn't that kind of strange? David, I mean, I don't recall his direct fatherly descendant being Abraham. Do you? He's shooting back. I mean, he's skipping whole generations. He's going to acknowledge later that he's skipping at least 14 generations. So he's emphasizing who the Messiah is. Son of David, and you guys will know that the messianic promises came through David. It was David's heir who was going to be on the throne all of his days. And he was going to be the possession of an everlasting kingdom. So that's the crucial bit there. And then Abraham. And we return to Abraham. And I'm going to come back to that in just a second and then talk a little bit. But before I do, I'm going to talk a little bit about the structure of the genealogy. you'll recognize that mine's set off in paragraphs. I don't know if you're in translation has paragraphs, but it's very helpful. Verses 2 through the end of about midway through verse 6, you have from Abraham to David. Midway through verse 6, you go from David to the end of verse 11, the exile to Babylon, the deportation to Babylon is how it's put here. And then from verse 12, you have the exile to Jesus at the end of verse 16. And then verse 17, in case you missed the point, right? Therefore, all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations. And from David to the deportation to Babylon, to the exile in Babylon, 14 generations. And from the deportation to Babylon to the time of Christ, 14 generations. So he's wishing to highlight three major events in the history of Israel. First, Abraham, the father of all of Israel. Second, David, the king of all of Israel. And then the exile that happened to Israel that was such a significant blow to who Israel was. Now, the most difficult one to know what to do with that is the exile, because this is a theme that is not as overt in the rest of the book of Matthew. Some people have made quite a lot of the idea of Israel still feeling like itself was in exile. Tom Wright has argued this. So that they never really returned, is his argument. But if I read most of the Jewish first century and intertestamental sources correctly, they really did feel like they'd returned from exile, even if they hadn't returned, even if the current glory wasn't quite as good as the former glory. So I'm not sure that I would go quite that far. But there is something about the exile that you find in Jesus. Remember, last time we read about Rachel weeping for her children and the nature of exile and also of return there. And somehow this is applicable to the life of Jesus. So, excuse me. I don't know how much more to make of that, honestly, except to note that there's a little twinge of a theme there, just a little hint there elsewhere in the book of Matthew. What is very clear, again, is the roles of David. And ultimately, I want to argue of Abraham. David, again, being the sire of the Messianic heir. And Jesus being great David's greater son. This is the true Messiah in the Davidic lineage. So that much we know. But if we go back to Abraham, it's interesting to try and contemplate what Abraham's role in this whole genealogy is. You'll know, of course, that Abraham didn't just have one son, namely Isaac. And Isaac didn't just have one son either, namely Jacob, whom we call Israel. Abraham was the father of more than just Israel, and therefore more than just the promises to Israel. And to substantiate that briefly, I'd like to turn to Genesis chapter 12, where we first really meet Abraham. The very introduction to Abraham in any significant way, aside from the genealogy that precedes, is in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. Very famous verses in terms of the covenant, and verses that we'll come back to later in a couple of sessions. Now the Lord said to Abram, "Go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you. And I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great. And so you shall be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you, and the ones who curse you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." Those of you, again, who've been around a church for a while, may very well know this passage fairly well. The idea of Abraham receiving blessing and then ultimately being a blessing to the nations, to all the families of the earth. Right? This seems to be one of the most significant roles for Abraham. Now, I think this role may also be hinted at throughout the book of Matthew. Because in Matthew, you do have Jesus in contact with the Gentiles. But most importantly, course, you will recognize at the very end of Matthew, in Matthew 28, the Great Commission, All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations. So this is the universal scope. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations, right? There's the universal scope of the gospel. And yet it's signaled, if you would, at the very beginning of the book of Matthew in the notion that this is the book of the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David and the son of Abraham, who's the father of the nation Israel, but is also, by extent, the one who will bring blessing to all the nations. So, a little genealogy, beginning of Matthew. And again, the importance of reading, especially the opening of a book and the closing of a book, and seeing how they might bring themes that come together. So there's some thoughts, if you would. Now, for us, of course, that's no big deal. This idea of Abraham, blessing to the nations, the gospel going to all nations. But let's remember the possibility, and I think the likelihood, that this is a Jewish person in the first century writing to a whole bunch of Jewish Christians. All right? In a time and probably in a place where the Jewish people were likely ones who could feel that, look, the promises are to us. I mean, it's okay if the Gentiles are here, but they're kind of like extra members of the club. You know? They weren't given all the promises. They weren't given the Mosaic legislation, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the things that you see repeatedly in a lot of the New Testament is this issue of the relationship between Jews and Gentiles in the early church. You see it in the book of Romans. You see it in the book of Ephesians. You see it many other places. You see it throughout the book of Acts. And I think you see it perhaps here in a muted fashion again in Matthew, where he is reminding his Jewish Christian audience that Jesus is not merely the son of David, but he's also the son of Abraham. And thus the gospel goes to all the nations. And that's where our 21st century context can make it so that we don't understand the full impact of this first century narrative. Okay, so some comments as we open. How about if I lead us in a word of prayer? And then we're going to talk about more about first century context, actually. Father, as we come before you, many of us, perhaps most of us, of Gentile heritage, we truly should be amazed that not only did you choose your people Israel and give them great blessings and great privileges and great responsibilities, but that in your divine plan, you chose to bless all the nations, even though we are undeserving, and perhaps in some ways even more undeserving than Israel herself. And so we who are Gentile in this room would give you praise for that. We would also give you praise that in your great divine sovereign plan, you chose before all time to found a lineage that would come through David and to give him promises about a kingdom that would have no end. And that we are privileged at this age to know that that true king, the king who is king over all the ages, is our Lord Jesus, who is the Messiah. Father, make us your people who will live in the strength of the power of knowing that we know the true King, and who will live in the awareness of the privilege of blessing that has come upon us as all nations, a blessing we don't deserve. Also, use this time in this class period to your glory, in whose name we pray. Amen. Thank you. All right. The main course of today has to do with talking a little bit about backgrounds. I should review where we're at up to now in this class. We have talked about the very nature of interpretation, establishing its very possibility. And in the process, you'll recall that I drew a little diagram on the board. Right? Remember this diagram? Author, audience, and there is a series of hills back here that constitute the background of the communication of author to audience. Let's say here Matthew to his audience, okay? Possibly Jewish Christians. Greco-Roman, but especially in that context, we need to know the context of Judaism as it was expressed in the Greco-Roman world. The author explicitly drew on the Old Testament and on the life and teaching of Jesus. All of this under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. And then we're over here with our own cultural backdrop. And so we have to understand transculturally how this applies to us. Right? That's our diagram we drew fairly early on. After that, we talked about the possibility of doing New Testament theology and what that meant, namely, especially looking at the emphases, the particular theological emphases of different New Testament authors, such as we just did with Matthew. Ultimately expecting a synthesis, a unity to Christian expression that comes out of that. The last couple of sessions have been focused on determining what is our canon, what is the group that we're going to study. I mean, what is Scripture for us? And attempting to establish both on a horizontal level the historical progression that we can have some confidence in, that we have the real, correctly recognized canon. And on a vertical level, that in God's plan of redemption, the close of the of Revelation, at the cessation of a prophetic lineage, at the end of the Old Testament, Haggai and Malachi, was reopened with revelation coming from Jesus himself, who is the Word incarnate and is the true revelation. And that the apostles then bear witness to that, and that's where in the history of redemption we get our canon. Okay, so that's where we're so far in the class. It's actually kind of disconcerting to think that I can summarize the class in 5 minutes, isn't it? But there are a lot of details along the way, and a lot of things that I expect you to be able to articulate, such as, is it possible to have some idea of what the author intended to convey? You know? Are there gaps in the text? How would you defend the canon to somebody who might doubt whether it's just one of many expressions of orthodoxy, right? Or one of many expressions of Christianity, the so-called orthodox party that won out? And, you know, how would you articulate this and perhaps the relevance of this for us today? So that's where we're at. Our next stage, you would think, would be to launch into our study of the canon itself. But I want to take a little bit more time with some of the elements of this drawing before we get into studying the theological themes and the history that we find in the canon itself. In particular, I want to help us locate something about the context in which the author and the audience are communicating with one another. The background, if you would. Okay? And then eventually we need to talk about the Old Testament and its role in the early Christian community. And then we need to talk about Jesus and what Jesus taught in his life. And then we'll be ready to start talking about the emphases that we see in the particular New Testament authors. All right? So today is backgrounds. And this will probably go into a little bit of next time as well. Then we'll talk about Old Testament, and then we're going to talk about the historical Jesus and who Jesus was. In a climate of the 21st century, many would tell us that we can't assume that the Gospels provide accurate accountings of who Jesus is. So what can we say about the historical Jesus? Well, I think the Gospels do provide as an accurate accounting, but along the way we need to talk about some of the complexities of that issue. So, this time, in the future, and right after that. And then we'll get into this. And we'll start talking about Matthew, actually, a little bit more. All right? So that's where we are. Now, you will have read by now, I hope, the first 150 pages or so of Bruce's New Testament history. And there he recounts for you a lot of the history and the background that I want you guys to know. But I also realize that there's a lot of details there So some of you are wondering, okay, do I need to remember all of Herod's sons that he knocked off before he finally established a kingdom? Do I need to remember the exact lineage of the Hasmoneans? And the answer is basically no. I want you to get a general flavor for it. But there are other details that I really do care about, such as who are the Pharisees vis-a-vis the Sadducees vis-a-vis the Essenes. Okay? So what I want to do in this lecture is to highlight some of the things that you will have read about. Okay? And so that's what we're going to do in our series on the New Testament backgrounds. Now, let me also say that your handout, right after the canon handout, there's lecture number 5 that begins with basic backgrounds for New Testament study. Okay? So it would probably be helpful if you have this open. It would be helpful because we're actually going to trace down through this whole series of pages here. Okay? So that's what I expect you to have. Okay. So anyway, we'll trace through that as we go through this. Okay, New Testament backgrounds. Now this is my general introduction to New Testament backgrounds that I bring into my exegesis class, that I bring in here, and ultimately it's how I start a whole class that I teach on New Testament world. So I know, for instance, Charlie in the front row here, and a few others of you might be with me in New Testament backgrounds, and this will be a bit of a repeat for you, but that's okay. It's good to know the essentials really well. And in any case, this is kind of the baseline stuff that I think everybody should know when they're interpreting the New Testament. There's perhaps some stuff you would add to it, but you certainly need this much. Okay? So we will start. I'm going to have a variety of pictures and maps in here, and these are some of my sources. I'll highlight a couple of those. Actually, all 4 of these sources are worth you knowing. A number of the maps we're going to see early on are from Barry Beitzel's The Moody Atlas of Bible Lands. Moody Press is known for especially popular books, many of which are quite edifying but are very popular. This is an exception there. This is a very fine atlas with some excellent maps, so I recommend that. If you're interested in the classical world, then the Oxford History of the Classical World is very helpful. This is a very thick volume on Judaism. Perhaps a thinner introduction to Judaism could be found. If you're interested in following up on some of the things that I say here, one of the books that I require in my World of the New Testament class is a book by Everett Ferguson, called Backgrounds of Early Christianity, I think, right? It's in a 3rd edition now. And if you want to read more about early Christianity as backgrounds, then that would be a good resource for you. Right. And then finally, Mary Beard's volume on the religions of Rome is extremely helpful. Volume 2 is entirely a source book, which has a lot of very interesting texts and pictures about what religion looked like in the pagan world. As we get started here, I want to talk about the geography of Palestine. Now, geography is not the most exciting topic for people, I know that, and yet it's often extremely significant. We here in St. Louis live at the juncture of 2, if not 3 rivers, but especially 2 major rivers, the Mississippi and the Missouri, and if you know anything about the history of America, you'll realize that those were very important rivers had a lot to do with the expansion of the Anglo expansion throughout the Americas. It's especially the case when you live in a society that is not as technologically savvy as we are today. Even today, geography is important. I mean, for instance, would you guys go raise a watermelon patch out in the middle of the Gobi Desert? You know, or that's not the Gobi Desert's not our issue, but say one of the deserts in Arizona. You're going to have to do a lot of irrigation. There's going to be a lot of things you have to overcome there. So geography is often extremely important, especially so in the ancient world, where technology was more of an issue. This is washing out slightly, but what you see here is an elevation map of Palestine. Okay, so if I can highlight some things here. Here's Jerusalem, right here. This is the Dead Sea that you'll know about. Here's the Sea of Galilee. coming down from the Sea of Galilee is the Jordan River, right? So this is known as the Jordan Valley. Jerusalem is almost at the towards the height of what are known as the Judean Hills. And to the west of the Judean Hills is the coastal plain and then the Mediterranean Sea. When you're over here, you're into what is the modern land of Jordan, and it has kind of the, what is known as the Eastern Plateau right through here. So, elevation. Now, elevation is actually very important at times. For one, it makes for good defenses. Okay? So if you're located up high, that's a good thing. It also means that there are certain areas that you are going to most have to defend. So, for instance, right here is the Jezreel Valley. And to defend the Jezreel Valley, because that's a smooth area, it's not, it's going to be harder to defend. You're going to have a fortress out there, and the fortress is known as Megiddo. And the valley is sometimes also known as the Valley of Armageddon, because it's the Valley of Megiddo. So that's, you know, one of the realities there. The other thing that is true about this, well, let me, two other things. One, did you know that this whole area, including the Dead Sea and the Jordan River, is still part of the African Rift Valley? This major fault line that runs through Africa all the way up into the Middle East is a major geographic fault line. Earthquakes are extremely significant in this area. So much so that a lot of the places where current archaeological excavation is done, for instance, and I've had some small hand in this, where current archaeological excavation is done, is in cities that have been devastated by earthquakes. And often the city will be so destroyed that they simply rebuild on top of that older city. Because if you're interested in building a city, what are some of the things that you're most looking for? Again, it often has to do with geography. One, you need a defensible area. So you're looking for a hill, if you can get a hill. Two, you need a decent water source, especially in a very dry land. So you need water. Three, you need decent land for agricultural purposes. And then four, you want to be on a major trade route so that you can have some economic trade. So major cities in the ancient world had those four characteristics. Defensible, they had access to water, they had decent land, and they also were on major trade routes. Now, some of those things don't change. The trade routes don't move very often. The water sources don't tend to move. You're looking for springs mostly. If you're dealing with anything aside from right off of the Jordan River, anything east of the coastal plain, of the top of these mountains, has very little water. So you're looking for a spring or a river or a wadi. A wadi is an occasional river that comes down in the kind of the wet time of the year. So those things don't move. So if your city is destroyed, you're most likely going to want to build right on top of it again. Because actually it's a little taller that way and even more defensible. All right. So most excavations in the ancient world, if you go back, you'll have layer upon layer upon layer upon layer. So I've been involved in an excavation at Abila, the Decapolis, which is just right about here, right off of the Sea of Galilee. And that city has continuous habitation basically from the early Bronze period, which would predate the time of Abraham, through the Iron Age periods, which is the time of David and Solomon, into the Hellenistic and Roman period being the time of Jesus, and well into the early and middle Islamic periods. Okay? And they just kept building city upon city upon city upon city. That's just how it's done. And so therefore, if you're going into archaeological excavation, you're tearing down through a layer. It's very destructive. It's called a destructive science because you got to take off the Roman layer to get down to the Greek layer. You've got to take off the Greek layer to get down to the Iron Age layer or whatever you want to get down to below it. And so that's kind of part of the reality of excavation. Anyway, now, The other crucial bit about this geography of Palestine is you get winds that blow off of the Mediterranean Sea, right? And that brings with it precipitation. But it's tough for those winds to make it over the Judean hills. So you'll see here a map of the rainfall of Palestine. Okay? And basically the warmer colors are the ones that are dry, and the cool colors are the ones that are wet. So green's good, purple's really good. Yellow or brown or orange is very dry. So the realities of Palestine are, again, it's all green right through here, right, on our map. And if you get north of Palestine into what would be deemed Lebanon, for instance, today, it can be very wet up there. Whereas on the east side of the Judean hills, coming down from Jerusalem, this is known as the wilderness area. Not because there's lots of tree growth, but because you're basically into a desert, and it's very wild in that respect. Okay? And especially as you move down towards the Dead Sea. So this had a lot to do with habitation patterns that you find in and around Palestine. Now, the major exception to that, again, is if you're right on the Jordan River, which kind of snakes its way. It's on this map, it's drawn very straight, but if you get down to it, it literally curves a lot in very short order. It's very wet right through here, and pleasant off of the Sea of Galilee. The Dead Sea is aptly named, as you'll know, because it's a saltwater lake, and it's difficult for much to grow there. So that's part of the rainfall of Palestine. Now, another aspect of rainfall in the ancient world has to do with rainfall in the whole of what we would call the ancient Near East, Mesopotamia, on through Israel and into Egypt. So again, the blue colors are lots of rain, and there's also a number of rivers. So here's the Euphrates and the Tigris rivers, right? Those two great rivers of the Middle East. So basically, you could live, if you were right on these rivers, or if you were north of them, and you could also, it was still decent land if you came over down through Israel here. So this is known as the Fertile Crescent, because people could live basically in this kind of crescent right through here, right? Whereas elsewhere, you have the Syrian desert and then the Arabian desert. It is possible to traverse the Syrian and the Arabian deserts with camels and very attuned guides and for people who are willing to take a major risk. But basically, if you want to conduct any major trade, economic trade, you are best off staying in this fertile crescent. And especially if you think through the great powers of the Old Testament, which were also the great powers right before the time of the New Testament, the Mesopotamian area, whether it be Assyria to the north or Babylonia to the further to the south, that area, and then Egypt, which is just off the map right here. So how are you going to get from Egypt over here, where you're going to have to traverse right through the land of Palestine and Israel? That made it a very strategic location. And frankly, that explains a lot of the history you find in your Old Testaments. Because I like to think of Israel as the Poland of the ancient world. It's my great little illustration. Poland, you know what Poland is? It's a plain between Germany and Russia. And that's almost all of Polish history. It's that place between Germany and Russia, and only in this century, for any extensive time, for the last millennia or so, has Poland been an autonomous country. Because usually it's Germany, Russia, Germany, Russia, Germany, Russia, trying to take over this plain that's in between them, namely Poland. And the same is true in antiquity. But there it is Mesopotamia, Egypt, and what lies in between is Israel. And that's your Old Testament in many respects, in the historical books. It's also very relevant to the time immediately before the New Testament. We'll talk about that in a moment. One final map here has to do with the road system then through Palestine. You'll see that there's a number of roads. The darker roads are well-traveled international roads. The red roads that you can barely see, those are maybe a little more regional. That's how he marks them here. In any case, you'll see the number of roads that go north-south, and especially these roads going into Egypt and then taking you up into the rest of the Fertile Crescent. It's a major area of commerce today. Now, this then has to do with the history of Palestine. And we're now on your sheet. There's a variety of dates that you simply should know. And the dates that I'm most concerned about, I've put in bold and italics on your sheet. Okay? By no, I mean they will be on the midterm. Okay? In case anybody had any doubt of what no meant. Now, I know that the study of history and the memorization of dates is something that you have a kind of natural inclination against, because you were, throughout your junior high and high school career, you had to memorize so many dates that just seemed useless to you. I mean, if you had an education like mine. But there are some dates that are so important, you just have to know them, because they allow you to put other events in a kind of relative chronology to one another. So, for instance, when we eventually get to the destruction of the Jerusalem temple, when was that, by the way? That's right, AD 70. And that is so huge that suddenly the nature of Jewish religious worship changed radically. And that meant, actually, some major changes for early Christianity as well. Very important date. And so, therefore, actually, almost every book of the New Testament, technically, in an introduction such as the one you'll read parts of from Carson Moo and Mortis, the big question that everybody debates is, was this book written before the fall of Jerusalem or after the fall of Jerusalem? It's that important a date. Okay. So that's why there's some important dates here. Now, we are actually going through the intertestamental period. You'll remember that Josephus indicated for us that there was a history that occurred throughout Israel after the time of Artaxerxes. But it wasn't and it was recorded, but it wasn't recorded because there was, in a scriptural sense, in a sense that you had scripture, because there wasn't an exact succession of prophets. But there was history. And there was actually, frankly, a lot of very significant history. All right? So one example of that, Israel's history can often be traced through some of their most important regular celebrations. So you can think of Passover. What does Passover recall? Yes, yes? Leaving Egypt, the Exodus. That's right. So Passover is very important for that regard. You can think of the Feast of Purim, Esther. And the fact that Israel was saved from Haman's designs on trying to destroy all of Israel. There's another little festival. Does anybody know what Hanukkah represents? It's the Maccabees. That's right. It's the time of the Maccabees. And it has to do with a time when a Greek Hellenistic leader from the Seleucid Empire took over Jerusalem and actually established the worship of Zeus in the temple in Jerusalem, and how the Maccabean revolt recovered the temple for true worship of God. Okay? Now that's something that's not in your Bible, but it's such a significant event in the history of Israel that it is recorded in festivals that are practiced even to this day. Okay? So there's some really important stuff that happens here, and so we need to talk about that. Now, in 721, Israel is taken into exile into Assyria, and that's the end of the northern kingdom, recalling some of your Old Testament history now. The Babylonian exile of Judah took place roughly in 587. Some people would say 586, but roughly 587. There were actually three exiles into Babylon, but the most important one is that of 587, because it was the most devastating on Judah and especially on Jerusalem. In 539, Cyrus of Persia overtook Babylon, okay, and he established the Persian Empire. Now, the Persians were a lot more kind to their captive colonies, if you would, than the Babylonians, whereas the Babylonians tended to take leaders away from their main cities and destroy the walls of the cities and destroy the temples of the main cities so as to devastate the cities and to bring them into abject submission to the Babylonian Empire. The Persians were a lot more kind, and they were happy to have the indigenous leadership in place to allow them to do their own worship and even within some restraints to build walls again so that people have protected cities. Not to protect them, mind you, from the Persians, but to protect you from thieves and robbers and bandits and that kind of thing. Therefore, within a year or so after Cyrus took Babylon, he permitted the initial return of some exiles into Judah. And it's shortly after that time that you have the rebuilding of the temple and also ultimately the rebuilding of the walls around Jerusalem. And that's narrated for you in the book of Ezra and Nehemiah. Okay? So this is these are some of the events coming out of the Babylonian exile especially. Now, Persia had a much bigger empire than that. Persia's empire, we'll see a map here in just a second, reached not merely to Israel, to Palestine, but all the way through Asia Minor, and they were trying to take over Greece. And they also had some arms into Egypt. That's how big this empire was of Persia. All right. So they were the big powers of their day. I mean, a huge power of their day. But in 449, possibly 448, the Greeks regained the autonomy. The Ionian Greeks regained the autonomy of some of their territory. And this marks kind of the steady march backwards of the Persian Empire. So it's moving from the territory that it had before back to a new territory. And this is the Babylonian Empire. Here's Egypt. This is Babylonia. Here is Palestine. This is Asia Minor. Up here is Macedonia. And down here is Greece. And then, of course, Italy. The Persian Empire, as you see on this map, it's at the beginning of the 5th century B.C., extended here into what we would call Libya today and Egypt, all the way here encompassing the whole of the Fertile Crescent down to the Persian Gulf, all of Asia Minor, and here into Macedonia, and they were trying to take over parts of Greece. That's how big the empire was. Right? Now, after that empire, and I'll turn these lights back on, the Greeks and especially the Macedonians grew more and more powerful. And the Macedonians, especially Philip of Macedon, was able in some very key battles to make sure that Macedonia was the rising empire up to the west of the Persian Empire. Right? I kind of showed you where that was on the map there. And Philip had a son, and his son's name was Alexander. And there's a movie recently. I know you guys may have seen the movie. I haven't actually seen the movie. I understand that it's all right. That's what I understand. And I'm not sure that I can vouch for all the history of it. But Alexander was this amazing man who, in the course of the 30-some-odd years of his life, captured almost all of that Persian empire that you just saw for the Greeks. So he completely reversed history. Whereas the Persians had taken over that empire, now the Macedonians have marched back and retaken the whole of the Persian Empire. And there's some key dates here. One is in 336, he becomes king of Macedon and general of the Greeks. And really, it's at that point that he's able to start launching his expedition towards the east. within 6 years, he has taken the whole Persian Empire to the extent that he is named the great king of the Persian Empire. And then just 7 years later, he dies. When he dies, he had some children, but being only 30-some-odd years old, you can imagine these children were pretty young. And so there wasn't a clear lineage of succession that he left. And instead, the succession was pretty much left to his generals. And the successors are known as the Diadochoi. And they divided the kingdom, roughly, into three most important areas. The Ptolemies had Egypt. The Seleucids had Persia, or especially what we would know as the Mesopotamian area and Asia Minor. And the Antigonids maintained Macedon. All right? So here's a map to show you a little bit of what that looks like. All right? You'll notice again that this is roughly the same extent, in fact it's a little even further east, of the Persian Empire. So again, we have Egypt down here, here's Palestine, here's the Mesopotamian area, and then here's Asia Minor up here, and there's Macedon. All of this was under Alexander's control, and in fact that line that you see that goes from Macedon down here through Israel into Egypt, then back out of Israel toward Persia, then comes this direction, and if memory serves, it goes north, and then he comes here, up through here, down, back around, and this is where he dies. That's what Alexander did in under 20 years. He was a busy guy, did a lot of marching. That's what he conquered. But on his death, it was divided into three different areas, and these people, it wasn't like it was a nice division. Okay, it wasn't like they're happy with each other. Well, let's sit down, have a little meeting, we'll divide it up. They each wanted each other's territory. The Macedonian, the Antigonids, ruled up here in Macedon. The Ptolemies had Egypt here, and notice that the beginning of the Ptolemaic period, they also have all of Palestine, meaning that Jerusalem, Judah, all of that is under the rule of the Ptolemies in Egypt. And then this area that's actually green on the map, that's, again, a little washed out, this whole area is the Seleucid Empire. Again, Persia into Parthia and also Asia Minor. Okay? So that's the reality. Now, note again where we're at. Trade, Egypt to Mesopotamia. Who's in between? Israel, Palestine. That's right. And therefore, people ultimately want control. And so the Ptolemies and the Seleucids are constantly battling with one another. Who's in between in the battles? Israel as well. So this explains some of the history that we have subsequent to that. All right. So Palestine in the Hellenistic period. Roughly at the beginning of the 2nd century BC, in 198, Judea moves from Ptolemaic to Seleucid control. So these Hellenistic successors of Alexander in Egypt lose control, and it goes to the Seleucids instead. Now, before we go on, I should step back and tell you a little bit about what Alexander brought with him. It wasn't just that he was a great conqueror. It was that Alexander brought with him all of Hellenistic culture. Technically, the culture of the Greeks, which the Macedonians themselves had adopted. And he brought with it, and the culture came with it, a language, Greek. It came with it cultural practices having to do with education. So you would establish gymnasia for the education of young boys, especially. It brought with it art and architecture. So most of the art and architecture from the New Testament period is very Greek or Roman in flavor, even in Palestine. Okay? It also brought with it Hellenistic worship practices in most of the lands, so that you had temples to people like Zeus, to gods, in quotes, gods like Zeus, Poseidon, and other more minor deities as well. All right? So that's what all of this brought with it, and it's what the Seleucids and the Ptolemies want to establish. Now, the Ptolemies were a little bit more, as far as we can tell, we don't know a lot about the Ptolemaic period in Palestine, but they were a little bit more willing to not engage in a forced program of Hellenization in Judah. But the Seleucid emperors were very interested in uniting their empire in part via culture. So they were willing to engage in a more forced engagement in Hellenistic culture. And one of the great events then in the 2nd century BC is when Judah, through a variety of permutations with its high priests and such, does not provide adequate support to the Seleucid ruler, Antiochus IV, while he's trying to battle the Ptolemies in Egypt. And he got really ticked off at them. And he decided this is time to really bring Hellenization about. And that's when he overtook Judah. He overtook the temple, established worship to Zeus in the temple in Jerusalem. It's when he insisted that Jewish people no longer circumcise their children. And when, according to the book of Maccabees, 1 Maccabees, he sought to also do away with all the copies of the books of the law. He is trying to completely undermine Jewish religion. And that is known as the defiling of the Jerusalem temple in 167. That is a date you should know. Right? Because it was so important. Because this could have been the end of Jewish religion as we know it. Except for a band of people known as the Hasmoneans. So, Antiochus Epiphanes orders the defiling of the Jerusalem temple. Now, as far as we can tell, a lot of Jewish people just felt like there was nothing they could do about this. But there was a family that had some priestly lineage that were asked to sacrifice to an altar in their hometown. And they refused to do it, and the father actually put to death the official who was going to ask him to do the sacrificing. And in the process launched a revolt. And the amazing thing is that probably, I mean, I think we have to acknowledge God's good providence here for the Jewish people. At the same time this revolt is going on, the Seleucids are also having problems holding on to their Asia Minor territories. And there's also issues with the rulership back in Seleucia. There's different people claiming the throne. And so they were weak in this particular period, and it allowed the Hasmonean revolt to basically succeed. This was a bane for Israel because suddenly they had their autonomy again, which they really never had under the Seleucid control and only had in some qualified fashion under the Ptolemies. But it also came, It was a blessing for them. But it was also a bane in a certain way, that is a bad thing in a certain way, in that the Hasmoneans got a little cocky, okay? And so Jonathan proclaimed himself high priest in Jerusalem. Now, the significance of this is that the high priestly line had been historically reserved for the Zadokites, okay? This one branch of the people coming out of Aaron. And the Hasmonean family did not belong to that lineage. So suddenly you have a high priest that is no longer a Zadokite. And ultimately, the Hasmoneans take on the role not just of the high priest, but also of the king. So you have a king priest ruling in Jerusalem who has only dubious claim to either of those titles. Right? Now, we now have the Hasmonean genealogical chart. Okay? This may help you with that one chapter in Bruce where he goes through all the Hasmoneans, okay? And I'm just going to quickly go through this. I'm not going to ask you to memorize this chart, but you have a copy of this chart in your handout, all right? It's like the third page or so, okay? So here's what we have going on. Mattathias is the father who effectively, at the very top, launched the Hasmonean revolt. Under him, he had five sons, and it was Judas Maccabeus. Judas takes the name Maccabeus. Maccabeus, by the way, do you know what it means? The hammer. You know, this sounds like, you know, the Terminator or something like that. So, but Judas takes the name the hammer and continues on in his father's stead. as leading this revolt. Ultimately, Judas is put to death. But after that, Jonathan, his brother, continues leading the revolt and ultimately claims the title of priest and ultimately of king. There was, as far as we can tell from ancient documents, some opposition to him being a non-Zadokite taking the title. Okay? And that somehow dissipated, but because by the time he died and his brother Simon takes over, the historical records indicate a lot of excitement that we still have a high priest and a king in the form of the Hasmoneans. When Simon died, his son, John Hyrcanus, takes over. And Hyrcanus was interested in expanding the Hasmonean kingdom, the kingdom of Judah, if you would. And so there's a number of wars that he engaged in. I'm not going to bother with all the details there. On his death, there was dispute between his two sons, Aristobulus the first, and then who only ruled for a year, and then his brother Alexander Janias, who ruled for quite a long period of time, as to who should be king. Okay. Alexander Janias continued in his father's policy of attempting to expand the Hasmonean Empire, the rule of Judah, the Hasmonean rule. And in doing so, exhausted a lot of the resources and made a lot of his own Jewish colleagues very disappointed with him, such that they launched a revolt against him, in part in the name of Aristobulus. And in doing so, they entered into a civil war in Judea itself. Judah was in civil war. Alexander Janias is ultimately the victor there. And the historical records indicate that when he had reconquered Jerusalem, he crucified a whole bunch of his opponents. And after his death, it's hard to know exactly the makeup of his opponents, because Josephus, our main historical source, is not clear there. But after his death, the Pharisees are considered to be some of his opponents, right? And actually, on his death, Alexander turns to his wife Salome, Alexandra, who ultimately is going to become queen, which is, again, something fairly unheard of in Judah, and says to her, here's the deal. You know, I should have made peace with the Pharisees a lot earlier than I did. So make sure whatever you do that the Pharisees stay on your side. To the extent that, give them my body, and they can do anything they want to do with my corpse after I'm dead. The Pharisees very wisely took Salome up on her offer, and instead of doing something very heinous to the body of Alexander Janias, who was possibly their long-held opponent, they honored him instead, and thus became the power behind the throne of Salome Alexandra. After Salome died, there was this kind of golden period that lasted just around almost 10 years. After Salome died, then the real troubles began, because there was disputes between her two sons, Hyrcanus II and Aristobulus II. But that brings us up to another very important point in history, which is the rise of the Romans. Okay? You notice that when you recount the history of Israel, you're not just dealing with this this history of this little land, but there's all these countries around it that impinge on the history of Israel. And so it's important that we study those. Roman history. Now, basically, these first few dates, I don't really care that you know. But it's just to say that there is a rising power in the West, and it's coming out of Italy. Such that after the Second Punic War with Carthage, that was the war that involved Hannibal and the elephants coming out of Carthage, and Rome was almost conquered, but they fought back very tenaciously and ultimately conquered Carthage, which is in the is a northern tip of Africa. And so the great power that was holding Rome in check was conquered, and that allowed them to move further and further east. So they engage Macedonia in war, which is just to the northern part of what we today call Greece, right? And they won that in 196. They engaged in one last war with Carthage, and by 146 they have conquered Carthage, and they've also put down a Greek, it was almost an insurrection, but a Greek war against the Romans. So by 146 they have all of northern Africa, they have Italy, they have Macedonia and Greece under their control, and they're ready to march further and further east into Asia Minor. And ultimately, that march takes them into Palestine, into Israel. And Pompey is the one who makes Syria, to the northern part of Israel, north of Israel, into a Roman province in AD 64. And by AD 63, Pompey actually enters Jerusalem. This is a date you should know, because it's another significant date in the history of Israel. Because here, yet again, here is a pagan who now, he doesn't establish worship practices in the Jerusalem temple, but he walks straight into it. He goes right into the Holy of Holies, kind of checks it out, and according to legend, was fairly disappointed, because there was no deity in there to worship. There was no image of an idol in there to worship. So here you have another pagan marching into Jerusalem. All right. By the way, the more significant one of those probably was Antiochus Epiphanes in 167. I think I mentioned maybe a time before, a couple of times ago, his name. There's a name that he's actually given in the book of Daniel, and that name is repeated in the book of 1 Maccabees. Do you know what the name that the Jewish people called Antiochus Epiphanes? The Abomination of Desolation. That's the Abomination of Desolation, is when Antiochus Epiphanes enters establishes worship practices in Jerusalem. They don't have such a harsh name for Pompey. But when the words the Abomination of Desolation occur in the New Testament, probably there is an intended playoff of the Abomination of Desolation, which you found in Antiochus Epiphanes. In any case, in AD 63, Pompey enters Jerusalem. Now, there's other parts of Roman history that are significant to us. In, again, this is kind of deep background. A few dates I'm going to have you memorize, but not these. A few years after Pompey marches into Jerusalem, Julius, who was the other great Roman general at the time, disobeys the Roman Senate and marches against the forces of Pompey himself. And he does this by crossing the Rubicon, which is a river in northern Italy. And this was the beginning of the rise of Julius to his status as Caesar, because he ultimately conquers Pompey and becomes the one person over all of the Roman Empire. It wasn't yet an empire at that stage. It was still technically a republic. But in 44, he's assassinated. Some of you will have read Shakespeare, Et tu, Brute, right? You know, he's assassinated there. And afterwards, the two major people, Antony and Octavian, rise up against the people who had assassinated Caesar. And the reason they assassinated Caesar, by the way, is they were afraid that the Senate was going to lose its power, which, in fact, it was going to do. And so senators rose up against him. But Antony and Octavian overcome those people in a battle of Philippi. You guys have heard of the book of Philippians, right? That occurred in Philippi. Philippi was established as a Roman colony and given a variety of honors from Octavian because of this event. But ultimately, things sour between Octavia and Antony, in part because Antony really gets excited about Cleopatra in Egypt, and is possibly making a play for the Egyptian territories, which was very significant, because Egypt was the origin of the grain supply for Rome. Rome didn't have enough agricultural territory. They had to import grain. So Egypt was a very important player for that. And also, in the process, Antony had spurned Octavian's own member of his family. So he gets mad, and he attacks Antony, and ultimately, in the Battle of Actium, he conquers. And the result is that he becomes Augustus, and he becomes Caesar, And from that point on, there is a Roman Empire, meaning there's an emperor and no longer a senate. Okay? Now, I'm going to finish up just briefly. This is the growth of the Roman Empire, which you can't see very well. So I'm going to pass over it. It's just to say that they grew from Italy and took over much of the known world around the Mediterranean Sea. All right. Pompey took Jerusalem in 63, and ultimately Herod the Great was established as the ruler of Judea. Herod was not of Hasmonean lineage. So if we go back to our Hasmonean genealogical chart, and we go through it very quickly, and we'll end on this, notice that Hyrcanus II ruled for 1 year in 67. And then his brother, Aristobulus II, took over from him. I mean, he launched a coup, really, in a sense. Now, this wouldn't have been too much of a problem. Hyrcanus didn't have a lot of grand designs, whereas Aristobulus was really wanted power. But Hyrcanus aligned himself with a guy named Antipater, who came from Idumea, which is east of the Jordan River. He's not truly Jewish. He's from Idumea. And Antipater really knew how to play things. And so basically, he enabled Hyrcanus II to get in the good graces of the Romans. So notice the date of the change in power from Aristobulus II to Hyrcanus. When is it? 63. What happened in 63? Pompey marched into Jerusalem, right? So the Romans began to establish the power from that point on. It was out of Roman power that Hyrcanus II began to rule in Judea. Okay. There was a short time afterwards when there was another revolt against the Romans and against the Roman established kingly line via Hyrcanus II when Antigonus, Aristobulus' son, tried to take over. Herod, who was Antipater's son, the Idumean son who had supported Hyrcanus II, Herod goes to Rome, gets back in the good graces of Rome, and then marches back into Judah and eventually conquers the realm that Antigonus had. Now, his only claim to the Hasmonean line, Herod the Great down here, is that he married the daughter of Hyrcanus II. That's his only claim. He is not in the correct lineage. More than that, he is not fully Jewish. That is to say that on the throne of Judah, you have a man who is not Jewish anymore. And this had huge ramifications going into the New Testament period. As you know, Herod, when he died in 4 BC, he had put to death a lot of his own kids because he kept being afraid that they were going to make a play for his throne. And the result was that he broke up his territory into three different districts, established over them two people who were fairly good at governing and one who was awful at it. And the problem is the guy that was awful at it was in charge of Judah and Jerusalem. So it was shortly thereafter that the Romans came in AD 6 and said, we got a clean house here because this is just not working. And from then on, except for a short period of about 3 years, there was no longer a Jewish king in Jerusalem. And that was huge. And that's part of the whole background that everybody in the first century knew. When Jesus shows up and people are calling him the Messiah of the Davidic line, and therefore it's looking like he's going to be our king. So you can imagine what they were expecting out of Jesus. All right. We will continue this next time. I hope you guys have a good weekend.